Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
It's always interesting to consider one's own perspective, not in order, as it were, from a third party to try and explain where one's coming from, not because it's necessarily important or, for that matter, unimportant, but simply because it may explain the particular perspective you have. Now, clearly, I'm a historian, and therefore, as an historian, one would like to think one could look at things in the long term and not be driven simply by the immediate pressures of the day or the moment, though I have to say, not all historians manage that, and I myself am sure that I am in no way free of the usual vices of the profession. But in my particular case, there was another factor to mind, and that was that last week I was in Estonia. And I was in Estonia to speak as the keynote speaker at the annual conference at the Baltic Defence College, which is a institution run by the governments jointly of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania to train officers and for such like purposes. And I think it's fair to say that one has a rather interesting perspective on British problems from the perspective of Estonia, a state, incidentally, where there is a British military presence at the moment, and a state which is covered by our guarantee of NATO through NATO. So in other words, if, as the Estonians think that they are next in line after Ukraine and Russia attacks, then by treaty, we are obliged to come to their help. And at the very least, whatever happens would be probably the most serious matter in British politics in the last, and you fill in the number of years. Now, from that perspective, the question of who might be running the British government does not always seem to be as germane and central as it may be if one is in the lofty portals of the BBC or other matters of opinion within the United Kingdom. But in this particular case of my trip to Estonia, I'd been to Estonia several times before, but in this case, particularly this came to the fore because the topic of the conference was the NATO doctrine of social community resilience, the idea being that societies, NATO societies, hopefully, that were, and allied societies, that had a degree of social resilience would be best placed to take the shock of conflict, and even more, the shock of being invaded and then having to mount not just resistance, but also a resistance from the context of being occupied. And I was asked to put this in its historical context, past, present and future. So I spoke, but I was also mindful of the other papers I listened to. And I had interesting separate conversations, British ambassador, the British defense attaché, and the various military people that were there. And I think it's fair to say, as a conversation I had with the senior American present, American Major General, we agreed that neither his society nor my society were actually showing much sign that they had much that one might consider in terms of social resilience at the present day. Now, you can define social resilience and the challenges to it from a number of different perspectives. I wish to talk about Britain, but if you're looking at the United States, there is a plague on all your houses. You could define it as much to include anarchists on the streets of Portland as you could define it in terms of a former president who is unwilling to accept a democratic verdict. So, you know, and conspiracy theorists left, right and centre. So the Americans offer plenty of food for thought, but it's my case here to be talking about Britain. And in Britain, there is the sombre situation there whereby whatever happens in terms of the parliamentary politics, either within the Conservative Party or between the Conservative Party and other political parties, there is an essential question of the governability of a country in which there are significant public sector strikes, both existing and threatened, in which there are significant law and order issues with now armed shootings, murders on the streets of the capital, seemingly a daily occurrence. There is the question about whatever you might think of the benefits or otherwise of migration. Certainly in terms of public policy, the country is unable to control illegal immigration with all the potential that has for the spread of terrorism and other challenges to the national interest. But also there is the question, the broader question, I've used the term the national interest, of what you conceive of the national interest and whether you think Britain, or for that matter America, has a capacity to integrate democratic governance. And of course, places like Estonia or Ukraine are democracies, or Taiwan for that matter, are democracies, with other aspects that you might consider and might assess to be necessary in terms of a world in which conflict is becoming, despite all of that talk, do you remember those amusing academics who pontificated to the extent that war had become obsolescent? As Martin van Krefeld, for example, wrote an enormous book for Cambridge on that. No doubt that had been through academic readers and it was pontificated on accordingly. And it said, there have been other intellects. There's a famous Harvard professor who's argued that the world is becoming less violent. Well, I'm not quite sure if I was threatened by the inroads of Mexican drug cartels, let alone Russian missiles, that I would have as confident a view as these commentators. So there are those challenges. There are the challenges posed by economic difficulties, the challenges posed by overpopulation, rapidly growing population. COVID, of course, was completely ineffective from that point of view. There are the challenges posed by environmental change, and one could go on. Now, given that context, one might therefore think about how best to conceive of British political history over the last year, over the period since COVID, over the period since the end of the Cold War. One can look at various different frameworks. And as ever, there is the problem that arguments that are advanced in a particular context are often advanced for partisan reasons without people necessarily contextualizing it. So you might, as a listener, feel that it was wrong to change Prime Minister twice recently without any electoral voice on the matter. But that, of course, is what happened when the Conservative Party changed its leaders in the 1950s, when Labour changed its prime minister in the 1970s, when the Conservatives did the same in 1990, and when Labour again did the same in the 2000s. So it's rather extraordinary to take the view that it isn't in some way part of the both implicit constitution and an actual practice of how British politics operates. You might think that it was, as it were, wrong for party members to play a role in picking Liz Truss as Prime Minister. But of course, party members played a role in choosing David Cameron as Prime Minister. And again, one has to wonder whether so many of the arguments made from some position are either partisan in terms of between political parties, or partisan in terms of lobbies within political parties, as indeed one can think of the cases in Labour, in which there were at the time all sorts of questions raised about the way in which Labour had, with its constituency members, its MPs and its union bloc vote, had its own choice of party leaders and indeed Prime Minister, and that indeed furthermore seemed at the time to be acceptable or even democratic. Democracy, of course, is a house with many rooms, and people are all too often willing to argue or to shout that their view is the obvious one to follow. But that's not necessarily the case. And we always ought to look not just at the legitimacy of other points of view, but also at the fact that we are in a changing, as in our other countries, constitutional and political practice, and we shouldn't assume that just because something has happened 5 years ago, it is necessarily what happens today, or vice versa. Both of those perspectives can be advanced. Now, in terms of the fall of Boris Johnson, and then the fall of Liz Truss, and then the choice of Rishi Sunak, I think it's fair to say that they created a sense among some commentators of chaos, incipient chaos or real chaos, whatever the difference between the two are. I think also one could argue that in practical terms, they are not as significant as people tend to have imagined, in the sense that we got through these changes, as indeed we have got through other recent changes, with a lot of anger, but with singularly little political violence. Indeed, in terms of the assassination of a murder, I should say, really, of parliamentarians, it has happened most recently in Southend. But the people who were the murderers were people who were perverse, disturbed, evil individuals, and not representatives of a organized political movement seeking to, as it were, change the nature of British politics. The last time that occurred was with the Provisional IRA attacking both the Conservative Party conference and the cabinet of the Conservative government. And we haven't been in that situation since, fortunately. Obviously, the situation may change, and we may then have a different view on the stability of our and the challenges facing our political system. But one might actually argue that we can cope with serious differences of opinion, and that actually serious differences of opinion, both between political parties and within political parties, are a good thing. Now, a good thing sounds very childish. One gets made fun of if one uses that phrase, 1066 and all that. But the nature of democracy is that people do contest differently the idea of the national interest and the idea of how to advance it. Sometimes one might feel that the means of addressing that create an inherent instability. And that argument has been used by commentators, both of that country and from outside, about countries as various as Israel and Italy, and for that matter, with reference to whether the United States has governability because of the separation of the powers. But looked at differently, if the major challenge is one of authoritarianism, and after all, that is what one would imagine if one is considering Vladimir Putin's policies, or for that matter, the recent party congress in Beijing. Does one really want to see a degree of cohesion? Is it not better that we have what might at times appear to be a sort of farce? One doesn't want to call them a French farce anymore, because obviously the French are not have a different form of politics, but a kind of revolving doors farce in which people go in and out of different offices and holding different opinions. Is that not necessarily a better thing, with journalists and others often getting hysterical in decrying them, than the situation that one sees in either Moscow or Beijing or Tehran, or indeed most of Africa, or indeed much of the world? The number of countries and the number of the percentage of the world's population ruled by authoritarian political systems, or political systems which ever might be democratic but have, but by outside standards, have an extraordinarily high level of corruption. One can think, for example, of Pakistan or Nigeria, or whether one's allowed to say it these days, India, all of which are very corrupt by the standards of British politics. Given that that is the case, is it not a good thing that one has what might appear to be instability? And here we have to strike the balance, because clearly there is a contrast between instability in terms of handling the nature of the political system and instability in terms of taking one's private interests and private views, whether it's opposition to the use of petroleum, whether it's opposition to abortion or support for abortion, and actually then using those in order to obstruct actively the nature of society and one's fellow citizens. And I think probably we have gone too far in that extent. I personally think that the people who are blocking the roads, blocking the railways, threatening the life, happiness, health and livelihood of others are people who are not just extremely dangerous, but also narcissists of the worst type. Because part of living in a democratic system is to accept that your own views do not necessarily prevail. So if I was to be looking back, and here we're going over to you in a second, Graham, just to give you some warning to think about what you want to try and ambush me with. But if I was to be looking back, I may be dead this afternoon, but let's say at the end of the year, I was to be looking back at this summer and this autumn, I think I would be more troubled by the rail unions going on strike. I think I would be more troubled by the ability of individuals to block systems of the national infrastructure, such as the M25. I think I'd be a bit more troubled by that than the identity of whoever the Home Secretary is, at a time when the Home Secretary is still going to be accountable to Parliament. And the guess is that if you don't like the Home Secretary, that if the political system changes in the sense that enough people come forward in an election to wish for the change, or before the election in terms of putting pressure on a party leader, then they will go. And that could be equally true of people across the political spectrum. So I think that in a way we need to get a grip, and part of the grip we need to get is to consider, and for the BBC and other media to devote more attention to more serious issues of public security within Britain, because ultimately people trying to stop the country in pursuit of their own sectional interests or their own particular political views. You could argue that those are, in fact, by every stretch of the imagination, you people who are actually threatening the nature of society. But also we ought to be mindful that as it were, changing the government is not going to do very much good if the Russians invade Estonia or start dropping bombs on NATO and firing missiles on NATO staging areas for weapons to Ukraine. And at that stage, it's not going to really do much good to shout and storm in the usual fashion that seems to be what political language. Sorry, I should be doing better than this, but I had a little bit to drink at lunch. One should be able to handle this better than political debate in Britain at the present moment. Over to you, Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. There's obviously many different strands to work with here. The first I'd really like to pick up on is really what you've just been saying recently about the nature of which parts of seeming crisis are ephemeral and which actually have long and strategic relevance. A lot of commentators are drawing a historical parallel between the Britain of 2022 with the Britain of the 1970s, the level of strikes, the level of inflation, political instability, and the threat from Moscow. Is this a useful analogy? Obviously, one could also spend time pointing out the ways in which we differ from the 1970s. Is it a useful analogy? And should we actually perhaps see the first 20 years of the 21st century in Britain as almost unusually crisis-free, or the first 15 years, perhaps we should say, unusually crisis-free in modern British history?
Well, that's fascinating, Graham, and you've pushed together two very different issues there. So let's start. Is it useful looking at the past and looking for parallels? Well, it's always interesting. I mean, the whole point of the past is to open one's mind, and considering things in parallel terms is instructive. You could argue that even if you had precisely the same net of problems at the present moment as one did in, let's pick a year, 1975, you could argue that because the social context was different, in other words, a lot of society had been through the war, they'd had rationing, they weren't used to such high levels of hedonism, individualism, indulgence, narcissism as we're used to today, because only a relatively small part of the population were part of that trivial 1960s movement. I mean, the 1960s, as I always pointed out to my students, was as much to do with Billy Graham as pop concerts. It was as much to do with politicians emerging like Richard Nixon as any, or de Gaulle surviving the 68 crisis, as or Heath emerging at the end of the 60s as prime minister, than any sort of indulgence with what people are told are 60s values. So it's useful if you go through the mind exercise. What you have to be wary of is assuming that the past is a makes the present a foregone conclusion. That's always stupid. I mean, you associate that with totalitarian ideologies, whether they're communism or Nazism. It's not very helpful. Now, your second question, was there a period of sort of a benign, particularly benign period, as it were? We seek for the Edward Gibbon of our days to write about Tony Blair as if he was the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. That's presumably the subtext of your remarks, and you just allow me to fit in the pieces. Well, that's an interesting question, Graham. I do recall feeling at the time when there was the issue about the eggs and salmonella and chickens, and you may remember Edwina Curry, and that was the lead issue. This was in the late 80s in British politics for 2 weeks. And I did say to people at the time, we are going to look back at this period and think this is a singularly benign period in British politics. Now, I'm quite prepared for the critic to be deluged on Twitter saying what a vile person I am and how I've underrated the threat of salmonella, etc., etc., and their favourite aunt died as a result. I have to say, I don't care. I'm trying to look at things in a comparative basis. If you are saying the first 15 years was less serious than the situation now, then clearly you're correct. You can debate why that is, which is an interesting one. You get the view taken by some people who wish to, as it were, seek an original sin in modern British politics. And they will argue that the Brexit referendum explains everything that's come since, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's ludicrously simplistic. I don't think Vladimir Putin, for example, got up in the morning and said, my God, Brexit's coming, let's invade Crimea, and then follow up by backing the people in eastern Ukraine against the government of Ukraine, and then we'll attack Ukraine itself. I don't quite see it like that, nor do I see the fundamental fiscal crisis, which comes from quantitative easing and the overproduction of units of finance, paper instruments of finance, or in digital instruments, as one that is primarily British. Of course, it was primarily an American situation, which other people went along with. So no, I would say that many of the problems started earlier. I've referred to quantitative easing. Quantitative easing is a crisis that began in the 2000s. You could also argue, since we're talking in one of the elements of the Ukraine crisis about energy, it was in the 2000s that we started to see the North Sea oil, or the easily extracted amounts in the North Sea oil, running out. And of course, in the 2000s, we already had issues of governability. I wrote a book, obviously completely forgotten as most of my books are, but I wrote a book on Britain since the 60s, and its subtitle was Ungovernable Nation. And I was moved to do that in And I was moved to do that in response to the question as whether the Blair government's failure to overawe the lorry drivers' strike, despite assembling military forces to that end, represented a sort of fairly serious failure of governance. So I think there were issues prior to the Brexit referendum, which already were of great seriousness. I think that between 2016 and the passage of the Brexit legislation, I think it's fair to say that whether you like or dislike Brexit, whether you feel, as did, for example, Theresa May, that you voted for Remain, but nevertheless, the referendum had gone in a certain direction, and therefore you had to see it through, whichever your personal political predilections were, it was clearly a very important issue, but it also enabled politicians and commentators to not consider other fundamental points about how Britain specifically was going, as well as the West as a whole, as well as the world as a whole. So if you want to do the Greta Thunberg, it's all to do with climate change, then this really has got nothing to do with Brexit. If you want to take the view that quantitative easing was the real destabilizing force, and that's got nothing to do with Brexit. So you could, and there are all a whole host of other things in specifically to Britain, for example, low productivity, which are poor educational outcomes for most children from schools, a dysfunctional national health service, which was not fit for purpose, as was to be shown, incidentally, with the response to COVID. So there are all sorts of issues that I think one could argue should have been to the fore, but that people preferred they preferred to focus on the froth of a political crisis. You know, what the Supreme Court said, you know, not really very good lawyers, actually, let's face it. I mean, the very problematic attempt to interpret the Constitution in light of their own particular predilections. Lady Hale, not the greatest of intellects. So the idea being that this was of crucial importance to the country and that we should focus on these, I think that was a bit of froth, and I think we can see that. Then, of course, we had, like the most of the rest of the world, we were not unique, the same thing with the COVID response. During COVID, the population was going up, the population of the world as a whole, which has this year crossed 8 billion at a remarkable rate of increase, and indeed the population of Britain was going up every single day. But of course, if you listened to the way the COVID crisis was discussed, you would have thought this was the biggest calamity of our lifetime, et cetera, et cetera. God alone knows how they're going to get people ready for the prospect of nuclear war if they actually responded like that to COVID. And I think it's fair to say that that was, again, it showed the British an astonishing obsession with the present and, of course, an astonishingly narcissistic reference. COVID was principally a threat to people in my generation and above, in other words, the retired and the elderly. It was a pretty benign disease. You did not see very many people having to see their children die. It was, you know, let alone their grandchildren die. It was a pretty benign disease as major infectious diseases going, but you wouldn't have really thought that from listening to the discussion of it, and it was accompanied by a really quite pungent authoritarianism, both in terms of public policy and in terms of attitudes by those who wanted to close down society, that should have made us very wary of what our country is becoming as a society. So, no, I would agree with you that the last few years have been particularly serious. I would say that some of the reasons given are foolish reasons. I would say that more of the serious reasons were those of a global nature. And I would also say that there were significant factors prior to the Brexit referendum that already posed major challenges.
So, I mean, some of the French commentary that is I've been reading in recent weeks has basically portrayed the changes of government and Britain's various other problems as part of what is now a perpetual state of crisis in the United Kingdom, to which in the French interpretation, this has all been unlocked by Brexit and is unsolvable. I'm curious by this because I mean, France at the moment, the president has lost his National Assembly majority and is forcing through laws by presidential decree. One could, from a different perspective, argue France is in crisis. But it's interesting the way people put their own interpretations and their own prejudices and their own predilections to the forefront of every interpretation of everything that happens. Nevertheless, has something happened following Brexit that has fundamentally changed the nature of British politics and British political discourse, insofar as the electoral loyalties have shifted somewhat in terms of what people in what regions and what different social classes support and back. There has been some forms of realignment, and simply the Conservative Party seems to be getting through leaders at a rather ruthless rate.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure it is a particularly ruthless rate. I would have got rid of Johnson much earlier because, quite frankly, he overreacted to COVID. It's a question of what you mean by a ruthless rate. But let's just sort of, if we can unpick this a second. You asked the question about British politics. My own view on Brexit is the most significant aspect for British politics is it's put further strain on the union. Now, you might argue that the union had been fundamentally destabilised, not by Brexit, but by Mr. Blair's decision that there should be a separate political and governmental agency for Scotland, and by the fact that his rather cynical attempt to hope that this would be a way to get Labour a permanent majority actually backfired and the SNP became the dominant force there. So you could argue that the most important thing about Brexit is it has brought to fruition already existing tensions in the relationship between England and Scotland, and that it is also brought to further stage the fact that the demographic balance in Northern Ireland was moving towards Catholics, and therefore it is more likely that at some stage Northern Ireland will wish for, or a majority of those in Northern Ireland will wish for union with the South, with the Republic. Now, those I think are both important. As far as Brexit itself is concerned, Britain was a semi-detached member of the European Union before Brexit. It wasn't a member of the Eurozone, and nor was it showing any signs of wishing to join. It wasn't a member of Schengen. It was a member of the European Union. It was a member of NATO. As a result of the Brexit vote, Britain has become a differently semi-detached member. You could argue it's more semi-detached. I would argue it is more semi-detached. But I think it is naive to argue that there was no tensions before. Hand, nor is it appropriate to argue that there are no commonalities afterwards. So again, I think a lot of people over-egg the pudding. Now, that's not something for the benefit of those listeners abroad. That's not something that translates very well, okay? Don't try. You ask about the Conservative Party. We'll leave aside, French schadenfreude. Of course, they should need to use a different set of phrases, but doesn't matter, different word, I should say. If you think about the Conservative Party, as with Labour, and it's not as though Labour didn't change its leaders frequently or try and change its leaders frequently between the mid-2000s and now. And indeed, if Sir Keir Starmer had done less well in the last 6 to 8 months, he might have been going walkies and been replaced. So politicians as a whole have not always been terribly brilliant. I ought to add that the same points could be made about other professions, military, for example. Some of their leaders didn't exactly cover themselves in glory in Afghanistan, etc. But going back to the Conservatives, what underlies the differences are, of course, in part things that, what a surprise, politicians are ambitious. Are you surprised at that? What a surprise. There are only a certain number of posts as you go up. But the more fundamental facts are there were and are serious differences of opinion within the Conservative Party. It is a coalition party, and the nature of British politics is that our two major political parties are coalitions. Now, remember, it could have gone a very different way, and counterfactuals play a role. If the Liberal Democrats had succeeded in their referendum, somehow they didn't exactly think referenda were a bad idea when they had a referendum for proportional representation. Now, a referendum for proportional representation would have seen Nigel Farage leading more than a sixth of the members of Parliament after the 2015 election. It would have made Britain far more politically unstable, but it might have made the political parties, the leading ones, more coherent. The Conservatives and Labour might have been shorn of one or other wing or other, etc. Is that necessarily a good thing? I don't think so. It would have been a different form of instability. So I think that there is, as you correctly say, I mean, you are simultaneously, you're different to me, you're simultaneously an academic historian of note, which I would hope to be regarded as myself, but you're also a professional and serious journalist and political commentator. Now, I lack such a platform. Now, you will know that your colleagues as political commentators have the exigencies, the disciplines of delivering copy and having to produce something to say that sounds interesting. You know, to actually produce an article saying, here we are muddling through again, this isn't very impressive, but it's not the end of the world, will not sell much attention. But I think that's something that really needs to be thought about. There is also, I suppose, if you wish to look at structural elements, a lot that isn't new. As an historian that has worked on British political history in the age of, if you like, parliamentary accountability, let me tell you, if you wanted to start with the 1690s, you know, after the Glorious Revolution, so-called, of 1688 to 89, you and the Triennial Act brings in regular elections in 1694. If you wanted to start then, let me tell you, you will find very few decades when you will not find some or other acute political crisis. Sometimes far worse in some respects than the ones we've got at the present moment, with the exception of the possibility that we might be nuked out of existence by the Russians. So I'm a slightly degree cautious about this. And some of the things we're talking about would have been regarded as laughable to have a row about in the past. I mean, you know, I personally think Johnson should have gone because of incompetence. But the idea that one is going to have this enormous sensational sense of outrage because he might well have told fibs. Well, let me tell you, far than that being the end of democratic government as we know it, it's actually part and parcel of our rich and varied history. So also with corruption, but of a very low level. I mean, at the present moment, the degree of corruption would be regarded as juvenile in many countries in the world and would have been regarded as fairly juvenile in some periods of the British past. So I'm not quite sure that the comparative context provides one with a high scent of gloom and doom for British politics. And as you know, I'm a depressive who's likely to always see the worst of things. I don't quite see it at the present moment of our politics. I might have been more persuaded that we were in a terrible situation if Labour was still run by Jeremy Corbyn. And indeed, one of the great reasons why I am unimpressed with so many Labour leaders, including Keir Starmer, and indeed my own MP, Ben Bradshaw, is that when other Labour parliamentarians had the brave and honourable stance of knowing, and they were right, that Jeremy Corbyn was somebody who could not be regarded as an appropriate future prime minister, they resigned from the party. So I have to say, I think, you know, Starmer, or for that matter, my own MP, are weasels. But once one takes that viewpoint to one, and I think Starmer will, it looks as though he's going to be the next prime minister. I think he'll be a terrible disappointment. I think he lacks the ability and the charisma and the personality to deal with many of the serious issues that one has at the moment. I mean, you look at past Labour leaders doing things like Gaitskill sending troops into the docks when he was minister in the late 40s. You can't really imagine Starmer doing that in a month of Sundays. But nevertheless, at least he's not Corbyn. So at least the politics, the fear that if the Conservatives continue to behave as they're doing at the moment, it's the end of civilization as we know it, obviously, you know, an overreaction in the first place. But at least there's really no role for that at the present moment.
Well, I think that's a note of what we call qualified positiveness. Or positivity to end on. Professor Jeremy Black, for giving us a wider perspective on the turbulence in British public life at the moment. Thank you very much indeed.
Can I cut in and say, actually, thinking about it, I did do a book, not just on Britain since the 60s, but a more recent book on Britain since 1945. And in that, which was published by the University of Indiana, in that I put more of a focus on social, economic, demographic and cultural changes in Britain, whether one was thinking of the rate of urbanisation, all sorts of changes to do with these factors in which politics played a role, but which are not generally grouped under the category of politics, to a degree wrongly, but nevertheless. And I would say that I still remain of that opinion. So listeners who might be interested in my views on Britain might like to look at that book, or indeed at my History of the British Isles.
Perfect. Professor Black, thank you again.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.